Good morning and welcome to ULT in Philadelphia. If this is your first visit, make sure you pick up one of these wonderful little pamphlets before you leave. Because it's our custom to tell you the purpose is to spreadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. For that purpose, we have a declaration that's very important. Please give us your attention. Because the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work, that end, is the dissemination of the fundamental principle of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self. A profound conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists wherever and however situated is similarity of aim and purpose and teaching. Therefore, has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards us Theosophists, all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, or creed, or sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. True Theosophy belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. This is the pamphlet for the last 3 months, April, May, June. We have one more meeting on Wednesday, June the 27th. And that will continue in the study class. And we want to make sure that we get it correct. Be your own heroes today. The study class in the ocean will finish up this coming Wednesday. I think that's correct.
That's correct. Right.
Sunday meetings, please pick up a document over there on the table that says summer 2018. And the classes will be in the Bhagavad Gita. And the first one, Wednesday the 4th, Sankhya Doctrine. Of course, you know, we open the doors at 5:15 on Wednesdays, so that you can spend a couple hours in the library to 7:15. That's 7:30, we begin classes in the room at 8:30. Today, be your own hero. We have a little reading from the Bhagavad Gita, which we will introduce this course with.
Can't hear you. That's a little quiet.
A little louder.
Seems much louder.
All right. Today's reading will be from the Bhagavad Gita. And it begins on page 17 and runs over to page 19. It's in the second chapter. Please listen. What, O Keshava, is the description of that wise and devoted man who is fixed in contemplation and confirmed in spiritual knowledge? What may such a sage declare? Where may he dwell? Does he move and act like other men? Krishna's answer: a man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which entereth into his heart, and of himself is happy and content in the self through self. His mind is undisturbed in adversity. He is happy and contented in prosperity, and he is a stranger to anxiety, fear, and anger. Such a man is called a Muni, a wise man. When in every condition he receives each event, whether favorable or unfavorable, with an equal mind which neither likes nor dislikes, his wisdom is established. And having met good or evil, neither rejoices at the one nor is cast down by the other. He is confirmed in spiritual knowledge when, like the tortoise, he can draw in all his senses and restrain them from their wanted purposes. The hungry man loses sight of every other object but the gratification of his appetite. And when he has become acquainted with the Supreme, he loses all taste for objects of whatever kind. The tumultuous senses and organs hurry away by force the heart even of the wise man who striveth after perfection. Let a man restraining all these remain in devotion, at rest in me, his true self, for he who hath his senses and organs in control possesses spiritual knowledge.
Good morning. So we have an interesting topic for discussion today. The word hero is a powerful word. Be your own hero. And that word can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So we wonder, you know, what are some of the thoughts? What is a hero to some people? Well, today we actually hear that word a lot on the TV. And rightfully so. We refer to first responders as a hero. We refer to situations in the military as heroic situations. Typically, we don't know who personally did it. But of course, in our pop culture, we have our heroes, be they Superman, Underdog, or maybe we're dating ourselves. But there are heroes out there. And one thing they all have in common is they're willing to fight for what's right. Another character trait of a hero is to fight for what's right at great risk to self. And we could go on with this, but we all know what a hero is. When we talk about a hero, however, the idea of the hero, it's almost as though it's important to personalize what the hero is, because there are all these different character traits of a hero that we can come to understand and emulate. And at the same time, it's best to keep that hero impersonal, simply because if we idolize someone as a hero, such as the greatest basketball player, and we want to be just like him, and we're going to practice basketball like we see so often, but then he falls from grace because this, that, or the other thing that so many humans do, then the child the idea of the hero is destroyed within the child. And so it's helpful for parents to help the child understand what true heroism is. It's not the person, but the character traits of an individual. That was the case in the West, commonly, in the ancient West, prior to the Bible. The literature that dominated the thinking in the West prior to the Bible was the Iliad and the Odyssey. And the classical heroes of the Iliad and the Odyssey, whether it's Achilles, Odysseus, and all of the other involved in really all of the Greek mythology and Hercules and all of this, the Iliad and the Odyssey and all of the adventures and challenges that were faced were metaphors and were taught as such. It was taught that many of the heroes were half god and half men, you know, Zeus and some, or half Zeus and a human woman, which is not uncommon, and that's what gave them all of these powers. But it was taught that whenever, you know, a child or a young adult would come up against challenges in ancient Greece, he would use the stories that he heard about Odysseus. Now, how would Odysseus handle this kind of a situation and emulate what is in Odysseus that's in me too? So that's how they would learn. That's how they would teach, based in principle, not based on what Odysseus personally thinks about whether you're a good person or not. That's the change that happened in the West, between ancient literature and then the Bible. Now, if we look at the Bible, we're not going to have discussion on the Bible, whether the Bible is historically absolutely accurate or whether it's fiction. We're not going there, but we will say that to the student of theosophy, whether or not the stories in the Bible are historically true is completely irrelevant. To the student of theosophy, what matters about those stories is the truth that the individual can learn from the stories. Unfortunately, what goes on in today's day and age, for those even who follow the Bible or go to church, is they have this ideal of what this Jesus Christ was. And he was something that I am not. He lived far away. He's not here and now, unless I really believe. It was very, very long ago, and it's not today. Things are different. And it's all about the personal God. That idea of such a hero is disempowering to the collective mind, because it dismisses the possibility of the individual becoming as great as the hero, developing the character traits of the hero, recognizing that there is the God within that I can become too. I just have to do the work that's necessary, prerequisite to become that God. So we'll start off with saying, anytime in theosophy that we hear the words long, long ago, or far, far away, it's probably helpful in whatever context, in whatever civilization, in whatever mythology, long, long ago, far, far away, it's helpful to replace that with deep within my heart, or in the process of my soul's evolution, because it brings it home. And if it was a part of us, then it still is a part of us. How can it be? It's all a matter of self-knowledge. So these are heroes of the past that the stories of which we can learn from and have been learned from since forever. But how can we be our own hero? Now, be your own hero. In this most recent periodical that just came out today, the periodical article came out for July, August, and September, if you take one on your way out the door. We have a quote from Mr. Crosby. The causes that each one sets in motion determine the path that one must follow. This might be called destiny, if we understand that it is a destiny of our own creation. Being created by us, it can be sustained by us or changed by us. If we do not like the destiny that befalls us, the effects that surround us, the conditions that encompass us, all we have to do is set in motion such causes as will produce other and more desirable effects. But we have to do it. We have to do it. No one else can do it for us. No one holds us back. No one propels us forward. So what he's saying is Superman is never gonna come unless you recognize Superman within yourself. So that's a different story than what we're used to hearing. Well, what is it about us? Let's say, all right, we're going to embark on becoming this hero. And it sounds pretty simple what he says along the lines of, all we have to do is set in motion such causes as will produce other desirable effects. Okay, but that can be pretty tough. Tell that to a heroin addict. Tell that to a sex addict. Tell that to a woman with three children who's in an abusive relationship. So tell that to someone who just has a bad habit and has had that habit for so many years. Setting new causes up, if we consider karma is action and reaction, and it's always equal and opposite. Well, if we've been doing something consistent in one direction for years, or perhaps for lifetimes, just changing that and countering it can be a big deal. So we can read about how to do it, but that doesn't mean we've learned how to do it. We only learn how to do it when we do it. And we have to start. But when do we start? Well, just as the hero typically flies in just in time to stop the train before the damsel in distress gets run over, there's always this timing thing. He's there just in time to save the day. Well, when should the day be saved for us? Is there really anything about us that needs to be saved? Is there anything about me that can't be improved? The fact is, if we're coasting along in life, we're probably going downhill, because you can only coast downhill. And so to reverse course is work, and it takes action. And just as the hero in the story arrives at the right place at the right time to preserve whatever he's going to protect, the decision has to be made by the individual that, you know what, this is going on long enough. Here and now is all I have. So why would I not take the steps here and now to correct in me whatever is necessary? But if I'm going to be my own hero, what is it about me? What do I have? You know, what do I have? What tools can I use to correct, fix, protect anything that's going on in my character so that I can transmute, so that I can be the better able to help and teach others? Well, that's the first thing, is we have to check our motive. Why is it that we want to be our own hero? If the motive is not right, the very tools that are necessary to become your own hero will never become available to you. We can make certain changes in our lives. We can get rich. We can attract a lot of people. But if our motive is off, then we're probably just creating bigger and bigger problems as we grow in certain ways. Well, what are the tools that we have at our disposal to become our own hero? One thing is, if we look at our higher nature, sometimes we use Sanskrit words because it's hard to describe some of the aspects of the human being simply because the words in English haven't been derived. So we're just saying this for benefit of new people. And that aspect is buddhi. We have a buddhi nature. That is our wisdom nature. It is that principle within us which is wisdom. And it is in the buddhi nature, you know, there are two aspects to it. Usually we talk about the aspect of it that is, it is the source of wisdom. It is the fountain of all of our inner knowledge. It is that library which accumulates all of the spiritual and experiences and high aspirations that our soul has experienced since forever. All is accumulated and assimilated into buddhi. That is buddhi in its passive nature. Buddhi in its active nature is will, or will power. Will is defined in theosophy as the force of spirit in action. The force of spirit in action. And it's what makes the difference between, it's what sets the human being apart from every other kingdom in nature, is that we can direct will. Everything else flows along according to the universal will, participates in the universal law. We can direct our will. And that's the problem. If we weren't able to direct our will, we would be in perfect harmony with universal law. And we wouldn't be human beings, we'd be animals. That's the difference. So part of being a human being then must be, we have to learn what it takes to participate fully in universal law, which is the same as saying we need to learn what it takes fully to participate in the truth. A man who is in search of the truth is like a part that's in search of the whole. When the man realizes that he's not a part, but he is the whole, and participates in the whole as the whole, he has found the truth. And he participates in the truth. He follows the law. So we have these, the use of will directed always by desire, but also behind our desire. You know, we hear often the phrase, behind will stands desire. And if we don't have a check on our desires, well, whatever desire, whatever direction our desires are headed off, that is the direction of our spiritual energy. And if it's selfish desires, then we have the results of our selfish desires. But we have to remember, just as surely as behind will stands desire, behind desire stands mind. The mind of the Mahatma has complete control over his desires, and therefore has complete control in the direction of his will. So what is it that we're doing as mind beings, as thoughtful persons, as reflective individuals, to gain control over our desires? The desires that we have, or let's restate that, we use the word kama, or our kamic nature, which is the seat of our desires. This is the seat of all the problems that we have in life. In essence, it's all grounded in selfishness. The Buddha said, suffering comes from desire. If we stop desiring things, we'll stop suffering, essentially. So there's this problem about desires. Desire, however, like everything else, is twofold. There are two sides to it. There's the lower desires, which are ambitions, which are what we expect our ambition or our desire to have power, to have control. And then there are our higher aspirations, which is our desires to grow and to be the better able to help others. Well, it's the lower ambition that is the source of the lower emotions, the envy, the greed. These are the things that hold us back. These are the things that we, as the hero, need to arrive on the scene and recognize them as the dragon and slay the dragon. It's our lower desires that ground us because of our own false beliefs of who we are. They ground us into this plane. They are the reason that we continue to incarnate, whether we want to or not. It's not the choice. There are those who are beyond their desires who continue to incarnate with the intention to teach and serve others. But the cause of incarnation among the mass of humanity is our desires, the hold that we have on things of this plane, rather than building up our treasures, as it were, in heaven. So as we take steps in the direction of eradicating our desires, and some of this we hope to bring out during the discussion, as we take steps in the direction, just as surely as it makes sense that no one else can do it for us, we created our mess, we have to fix our mess. At the same time, as we take steps in that direction, there is assistance that comes from within. There's a statement, it'll come later, we guess. But the assistance comes from within. And that assistance comes from our higher nature, our Buddhi nature. The more effort we make with the right motive, in the right feelings of, with the right emotions for doing it, the more access, interestingly, we have, or it's not the more access that we have toward our higher spiritual nature, it's actually we're creating the conditions within ourself more so that the spiritual nature, which is always there, is able to shine through more clearly with greater force and so that we can use it for good. So we're going to stop there. These are some ideas about the hero in us, and we'd like to open the floor for contributions and questions in the far back. Yes, ma'am. So if one's going to take steps in this direction, where does he start? I mean, there's a lot going on. There's a lot, self-knowledge and all this. There's so much going on. And actually, we start where we are. And for most of us, it's simply virtue. Live a life of virtue. So why virtue? Why is it that virtue is important to be Gami, but aren't all heroes recognized generally as virtuous individuals, first and foremost? Isn't that true? It's because virtue is not being a good person, it's not being a nice guy, it's not being liked by everybody. That's not it. Virtue is moral strength. Virtue is having the moral character to do the right thing at the right time when you know it's the right thing to do, in spite of the fact that other people might shun you for it, in spite of the fact that people disagree with you. If you know it's the right thing to do, and you choose to do it, and to do it without regard for yourself, isn't that what heroism is all about? The selfless acts, the risk that people take. So the first step, Mr. Judge says, is heroism. Excuse us, is virtue. Virtue sets up certain conditions within our nature, the results of which attract, are recognized by others who are willing to help us along the way. That's true in school. That's true in life. That's true in the job. Someone who's working hard, focused, and wants to be a contributing factor. The boss's boss, who looks out over the 30 whoever's, knows who he's going to spend his time on. And it's not the one who's always the best at what he does, necessarily. But you can bet, if it's a smart boss's boss, it's the one that he recognizes as a virtuous individual who's willing to do the work because it's there to be done. Yes?
We have a comment and then a question, please. In regards to the first question, wouldn't the first step be, before any of this begins, the process is becoming aware that there needs to be this change? And my question is, in regards to virtue, can we look at compassion as being the same? If somebody's compassionate, are they also virtuous then? Can we look at the two of them as, because we would think that a compassionate person would also be virtuous, but we're not sure.
It seems so. Well, compassion, all right, let's look at virtue. If virtue is, the strength of character, a person who is virtuous is willing to do the right thing because it's there to be done, regardless of the effect on me, then he'd only be doing it in service to those who probably need it to be done. Well, isn't that more or less the definition of compassion? Compassion, which is not a sentiment, which is not an emotion. A lot of people think an emotional person is a compassionate person because they like puppy dogs. No. Compassion is a power of the soul, just as will is the power of the soul. So compassion is the ability to identify oneself with the conditions to identify oneself as another experiencing those conditions and putting out the effort to help that person deal with those conditions in a more constructive way. It's not necessarily making the problem go away, but helping that person and going through the effort. And isn't that what a virtuous person does? Isn't that what a hero does? And there's two hands up. Yes?
Well, we always did love romantic tales. And most of us have heard Robin Hood.
Please speak louder.
Of King Arthur and the Round Table. It because here in America. And our familiarity with those heroic stories, when we approach what is given out here, we are automatically leading ourselves in the direction which certainly is far more rewarding. And we hear the term help nature, and we hear another term, nature speaks eloquently, but she feels the impression of that. Could you carry it from there to show how the terminology we use in the West compares to what we in the Gita and everything else?
That's above my pay grade. We're looking for help with this. We can't. We don't get it.
We didn't hear it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we're going to be studying the Garden of Ideas. You think that that's a story? To use the Western term, romantic. But help nature. This is how we get deeper and deeper into the moral ethical point of view.
Thank you. Sure. So, of course, the Bhagavad Gita is a heroic story, of course, and there are examples of heroism in the story. Perhaps the most important idea that comes from the Bhagavad Gita is when Krishna is explaining to Arjuna the value of skill in the performance of action. Skill in the performance of action in the Bhagavad Gita, if we're looking on it from the mental plane, on the plane of intelligence, the performance of action is how you think. The performance of action in the Gita is your thoughts. Skill in the performance of action, if you look up the definition of the word skill, is discernment and discrimination. So keep a check on your thoughts. How are you using your mind? Isn't it interesting? We call ourselves mind beings, and yet there's something within ourselves that can keep a check on how we think. So we really are more than just our mind. Work on with nature speaks back to, as you know, as we think, so do we speak, and so do we act. If we speak and act in accordance with nature, being, we'll use the term universal law, then we're participating to the in the purpose of the universe, aren't we? Correspond nature to right thinking, and that's the challenge that we have as human beings. Yes.
Goes back directly to the question about compassion and virtue. A person can be very heartfelt, very compassionate, and not have much independent thinking. It's just following their feelings. So they're not necessarily virtuous. However, the very fact that they're compassionate is more important than the person who's getting all this intellectual knowledge, because they're going to have to get compassion, which is more difficult to get. So the person who is compassionate will, by degrees, by life after life, work their way to virtue.
So it makes sense then to create the conditions within us where the light will shine through, where the compassion will shine through, even though we may not be the strongest of character. We may not have the power, as great power as as many others do. But if we're able to keep a check on our emotions at that stage and maintain the right motive, as we grow, you know, the tree will grow straight. So compassion in that sense, it is suggested, is probably preferable. Yes.
What we were thinking, wasn't Robin Hood very compassionate? But where did he get what he used to help others? He stole it. That's not very virtuous.
Thank you. Robin Hood was an example of compassion, yet probably not very virtuous because he stole everything. Yes.
And one thing we guess could be involved with this conversation is from the Bhagavad Gita is the idea of, and we think it was kind of touched on, about doing your duty but not expecting anything in return, but doing it because it's there to be done, and it's something that you created by your past actions anyway. So by doing whatever it is, then we're looking at the whole idea of being virtuous and compassionate here too, that as was because you're seeing that there's something that has to be done, and a hero wouldn't be doing it expecting anything in return. So we're thinking that to be heroic is to do your duty in the utmost fashion.
So doing our duty is somehow, some way, has to be related to being a hero. If we consider the idea that, you know, if in our effort to become the hero, we probably all recognize that, you know, there are certain principles of life that a hero is going to have to live by, or he wouldn't bother being a hero. He's not going to put the effort out for others. And those principles, the higher principles within, are of compassion, as we were saying, as the right use of mind, as virtue. They're all part and parcel to his immortal soul, the spiritual soul, or his human soul, the triad that we all have within us. So, as we, you know, how does one become the hero? How does one place the priority on the principles of the soul, making the soul the highest in his incarnation? There's a lot of us who have personal desires as our priority in this part, and forget the other guy, right? But how does one place the soul above the desires? The desire being the dominant principle universally at this stage of evolution. And there are steps that Mr. Judge talks about, the first of which is, and among which are, the right performance of duty, the eradication of all desire, of all personal desire. Not that desire is bad per se, because there is the higher use of desire. The cultivation of that hero within, or the cultivation of the real body that the hero uses. And what we mean by that is, just as surely as we can exercise and make our body stronger, just as surely as we can read the right things and become smarter and more intelligent, so too there are certain things that we can do to develop or to culture our inner nature, the hero within, the inner man. And those things are taking the time each morning and each night to reflect on what went on during the day and see the operation of law in it, and to dismiss any judgments that we may have had in the evening, in the morning, to prepare, know what the day more or less is going to follow as, and prepare ourselves for it through meditation, by meditating 20 or 30 minutes every day. Doing these kinds of things puts us more presently in the moment, so that when we're interacting with people, we're not reacting, but we're responding. There's a tendency, this is the process of, in the evening, reflecting on our day and seeing the cause and effect go on without making judgments, just observing as the law works. That is known as Pythagorean retrospection. And one of the benefits of it for someone who does that consistently is that through the day, when challenges come up, which theretofore he may have been reactive toward, he'll stop and think. And this is no secret. This is no secret. Police departments do this. When there's a big operation in a police department, they'll collect all of the videos, put it all together, and have the police officer say, this is what went on, this is what we did, this is how you reacted. And by reviewing everything, police officers in the next big operation are going to be more mindful. Every football team, the first thing they do Monday morning after the Sunday night football team, the coaches review that, and then they put the excerpts in front of the players. So that's nothing new. What we're saying is they're doing it because they know it works. And Pythagoras, that was something that Pythagoras taught in terms of the cultivation of the inner self. Yes?
Well, to do all of this, to do any of this, one must have the desire to do it. But that desire is only as strong as the will. How does one strengthen the will? How does one become more able to use it in a constructive way?
So the question is, how are we able to use our will in a more constructive way, which speaks probably to the idea of willpower? Well, first, there's a statement in the philosophy that will and desire in its widest application, desire in its widest, most universal application, is identical to will. Desire in its widest, most universal application is identical to will. But being men incarnated, we cannot recognize that for what it is. So we see will and desire on two different planes. Desire is what motivates the animal, and that same principle is within the human being. Both, it says, the teachings say that both desire and will, and she uses these words, are absolute creators. Desire is the creator of our lower nature. Will is the creator of our higher nature. So, in that sense, how do we better use will? Well, let's look at will as a force that, you know, it's not that we have willpower, it's just always there. It's like spirit is just always there. It's infinitely there. Do we develop the muscles necessary to use it for good? Well, behind will stands desire. In order to use it for good, we need to be able to focus our desires in the right way, on the right things, for the right reasons, with the right motive. And this speaks to contemplation, meditation, Pythagorean retrospection, because if we don't keep a check on ourselves, we tend back toward the human animal that we would be if we weren't thinking these higher thoughts. So how do we get there? Whatever is important to an individual, all the good people, we're not. Who do not meditate, if they start to meditate 20 minutes a day for 6 weeks, their priorities are going to change. What we value in our lower nature is very different than what we would value if we practiced in the development of what is called in theosophy self-culture. So how do we develop, so to speak, desire? When we meditate, we begin to desire less. We see value in what really is important and less value in what's not important. So the more we clean out the closet, the less distracted we are from the important stuff. So if we desire less, then we're able to focus more on what's left over and what's important. That being said, we have to also pull in the powers of the mind, you know, fixing our imagination, faith, will, and desire all go into place into this. Yes, and there's been a hand in the
purple.
That
goes back to the very first question. How do we start? The person who's starting is not able to meditate. They don't even understand what it means. They have to get a better basis of ideas. They have to read, think, question. But we think the most important step is, you're a hero when you get up in the morning if you're trying to do all this, to take your responses to anything that comes let's say you do something nice for somebody, and they never even say thank you, and your response is, well, that's rude, then you know you were acting for a motive for yourself, not for doing the nice thing. You don't beat yourself up, but you certainly noted, this is my motive in
observing.
And that's what you start working on, setting up better causes, checking your motive, and that will lead to meditation.
Thank you. And so keeping, you know, checking, keep a check on yourself. Nobody else can do that for you. That's early in the process, is keeping a check on how we think. Yes.
So the practice of doing something every day, eat at 9, lunch at 12, those kind of things. But then you have a spiritual life, and you say, well, when I get up, I'm going to take 15 minutes and I'm going to just reflect. Now, if I do that every day, I would think that would strengthen my will. But if I don't do it every day, if I do it for a few days, I'm not doing it. It's too much for it. And then it sort of weakens my will, because I haven't kept to my word, to myself. So is that logical in our thinking?
So the contribution here is, once we set an important pattern, we need to keep that cycle going. It's all according to the laws of cycles. And not so much that we have less will, but our use of will, the muscles that we use in directing will, tends to dissipate. Just, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. How many among us, don't raise your hands, have gone through many weeks of meditating, and we've done so well that we don't need to do it anymore, and a week or three later, things were a mess, and we wonder why, and we realize, you know what, perhaps that's what it was, and we get back. Yes, in the far, in the white.
And eventually, we're told, and some of us can actually say, I did try that it becomes routine, it becomes automatic, it's no longer something we have to line up in on paper and pen. It just happens. It becomes routine.
If we set the pattern, make it a routine part of our life, just like we eat every morning at a certain time. Let's remember what's going on when we sit and meditate. We're giving the opportunity to our mind to not be distracted by our desires, kind of like leave them in the placid lake, and let's take a minute to look at the sun, realize what's there, identify with that. When we go outside, if we can hold on to that as the waves start churning, at least we're not reacting to the churning, at least we're not starting to identify ourselves as the wave, but rather participate in the wave as best we can, and take it from there. Yes.
You touched upon it earlier, but you know, in the time in which we live, in the age, you know, every selfishness is reigning supreme, and then we see unselfishness in many departments, nature, and selflessness in all departments of nature, where they sacrifice themselves for the higher good, for the evolution of life. How can we, as individual beings, emulate that selfishness, unselfishness, and selflessness in our life?
So the question is, what do we need to do to purify our desires? Is there a way to do it? And actually, HPB says it is will, the right use of will, and knowledge. self-knowledge, spiritual knowledge. Maintaining, part and parcel to all of this, is maintaining that I'm not this body, that I am an immortal soul. I always have been and I always will be. I'm going through this challenge right now, a challenge that how many of us identify ourselves as and lose sight of who we truly are. Well, the teachings are that we need to make that effort, to do that fight, to first remember who and what we truly are. We are the source of all our problems, and therefore we have to be powerful enough to solve our problems, and how dare we expect somebody else to come in and wipe them away for free, right? Does that answer the question? It's the purification of desires, we think. Yes?
Just adding a thought on Joseph Campbell's work on the hero. The hero's journey is he is in the world and he sees problems, and his journey is a journey to the unconscious, where he faces monsters, witches, challenges, things. And his battle there, which are forces in himself, his own desires,
yes,
his own animal nature, whatever, and that through those challenges, he becomes heroic and he comes back to the conscious world and he brings back what he learned and he offers those gifts in service to humanity.
So he
brings that whole self, part of our self-knowledge is when we all are involved in that struggle of things that disturb us or upset us or make us afraid or all those things. That seems to be an essential part of cultivating our heroic self.
So then what the contribution here is essentially is the purpose and process of human evolution. We start as spirit, we end as spirit, and we actually had a professor of religion say, so with that kind of a theory, why even go through all of it? He was not a professor of theosophy. But we start here and we involve or involute into the challenges, the questions, the opportunities for strengthening, purifying, raising, transmuting, so that when we evolve through and back out of all of those challenges, we're back to the spiritual state plus all the wisdom that we've accumulated, which is contributed to the universal, to the universal wisdom. And last, yeah.
Back just to the question, selfish, unselfish, selfless. We think one way to step up a little with that is to use your imagination. You judge this person. Well, what if someone you really care about was doing and acting the exact same way? Would you judge them that way? No, you think of the reasons why it was happening, and you change your sort of selfish reaction to them to an unselfish one. We think it's a step-by-step process.
Thank you. So this selfishness versus unselfishness versus selflessness is all part of the process of becoming the hero, of growing, of getting past our own blockages, which are grounded in our own personal emotions. So with that then, the hour is up. Next Sunday, let's just talk about, now that we're at the end of the school year, we follow a school year from September to June, and we're starting in July 1st, we're beginning a pamphlet, it's a small book, The Epitome of Theosophy. Through the summer, we will go each Sunday, week by week, we will have a full survey of the philosophy as written by one of the founders. And that actually is every Sunday in July and September, but Sundays during the summer, during August, we take off. So we're still meeting July and September. And then also, please join us for Wednesday evening with the Bhagavad Gita. This next Wednesday is the last for the Ocean of Theosophy. Then the following, we begin the Bhagavad Gita. Our class is dismissed.